for this February 23rd, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your Tuesday headlines. A joint Senate hearing today looking for answers into the security breach last month on January 6th here on Capitol Hill, which led to damage and five deaths. Two of America's leading vaccine makers announcing they have fixed some of the problems which delayed distribution of vaccines. Executives from Pfizer and Moderna testifying today. Politico.com reporting that the Senate's Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, will support Merrick Garland's nomination for Attorney General. You might remember 5 years ago, the GOP leader blocking his nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Senate Judiciary Committee wrapping up 2 days of confirmation hearings for Judge Garland. Several Republicans already announcing their support to lead the Justice Department, including Senators Tom Tillis of North Carolina and John Cornyn of Texas. The confirmation hearings today for the nominee for Health and Human Services and the Interior Secretary, and the Senate confirming Tom Vilsack to return as the Agriculture Secretary, a position he held during the Obama administration. Just some of the stories shaping Washington Today, ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin on Capitol Hill with today's Senate hearing on the insurrection that broke out on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. At one point, the head of the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department telling senators that there was an initial reluctance to send the National Guard during the rioting at the U.S. Capitol. Testifying before a pair of Senate committees, the acting chief, Robert Conte, saying that at 2:22 p.m. on January 6th, more than an hour after his forces were summoned to the U.S. Capitol, he was part of an emergency phone call that included leaders from the Capitol Police Department, the National Guard, and the Department of the Army. We learned today that nearly an hour would pass before the Pentagon approved the deployment of more Guard troops, and then more time passed. Those troops would not arrive in the Capitol until 5:40 p.m. That was more than 4 hours after the chief of the Capitol Police Department had requested federal assistance. At times, witnesses recounting their own experiences on that afternoon, U.S. Capitol Police Captain Carnesha Mendoza recounting what happened.
At some point, the crowd breached the line officers worked so hard to maintain. Civil disturbance units began to redeploy to keep rioters from accessing other areas of the building. I proceeded to the rotunda where I noticed a heavy smoke-like residue and smelled what I believed to be military-grade CS gas, a familiar smell. It was mixed with fire extinguisher spray deployed by rioters. The rioters continued to deploy CS into the rotunda. Officers received a lot of gas exposure, which is worse inside the building than outside because there's nowhere for it to go. I received chemical burns to my face that still have not healed to this day. I witnessed officers being knocked to the ground and hit with various objects that were thrown by rioters. I was unable to determine exactly what those objects were. I immediately assumed command in the rotunda and called for additional assets. Officers began to push the crowd out the door. After a couple hours, officers cleared the rotunda, but had to physically hold the door closed because it had been broken by the rioters. Officers begged me for relief as they were unsure how long they could physically hold the door closed, with the crowd continually banging on the outside of the door, attempting to gain reentry. Eventually, officers were able to secure the door with furniture and other objects. I'm proud of the officers I worked with on January 6th. They fought extremely hard. I know some said the battle lasted 3 hours, but according to my Fitbit, I was in the exercise zone for 4 hours and 9 minutes, and many officers were in the fight even before I arrived. I'm extremely proud of the United States Capitol Police. I'm especially proud of the officers who are the backbone of this agency and carry out day-to-day operations. I know with teamwork we can move forward. The night of January 7th into the very early morning hours of my birthday, January 8th, I spent at the hospital comforting the family of our fallen officer and met with the medical examiner's office prior to working with fellow officers to facilitate a motorcade to transport Officer Sicknick from the hospital. Of the multitude of events I've worked in my nearly 19-year career in the department, this was by far the worst of the worst. We could have had 10 times the amount of people working with us, and I still believe the battle would have been just as devastating. As an American and as an Army veteran, it's sad to see us attacked by our fellow citizens. I'm sad to see the unnecessary loss of life. I'm sad to see the impact this has had on Capitol Police officers. And I'm sad to see the impact this has had on our agency and on our country.
And, of course, Officer Sicknick died on January the 6th following that insurrection. That firsthand account from Captain Mendoza of the U.S. Capitol Police. The Washington Post is reporting that an FBI warning of potential violence did reach the Capitol Police on the eve of the attack. But top leaders testified during today's Senate hearing that they didn't see it. Stephen's son was the chief of Capitol Police at the time. He stepped down on January the 7th. The warning had reached headquarters, but leadership in the Capitol Police, as well as the House and Senate Sergeants at Arms offices, testified that they did not see the report. It indicated that, quote, extremists were preparing to travel to Washington to, quote, commit violence and wage war. Here is the former chief of police for the Capitol Police Department, Stephen Sund.
The intelligence that we based our planning on indicated that the January 6th protests were expected to be similar to the previous MAGA rallies in 2020, which drew tens of thousands of participants. The assessment indicated that members of the Proud Boys, white supremacist groups, Antifa, and other extremist groups were expected to participate on January 6th, and that they may be inclined to become violent. Based on the intelligence that we received, we planned for an increased level of violence at the Capitol, and that some participants may be armed. But none of the intelligence we received predicted what actually occurred. Extensive preparations were put into place for January 6th that included the full activation of the department, intelligence and information sharing with our federal and local partners and department officials, implementing a significant enhancement for member protection, extensive operational enhancements to include significant civil disobedience deployment, and an expanded perimeter. We also distributed additional protective equipment for our officers and coordinated outside agency support. As recent as Tuesday, January 5th, during a meeting I hosted with my executive team, the Capitol Police Board, and a dozen of the top law enforcement and military officials from D.C., no entity, including the FBI, provided any new intelligence regarding January 6th. It should be also noted that the Secretary of Homeland Security did not issue an elevated or imminent alert in reference to the events at the United States Capitol on January 6th. We properly planned for a mass demonstration with possible violence. What we got was a military-style coordinated assault on my officers and a violent takeover of the Capitol building. I know that the images we saw of the officers battling for their lives and the visuals on national TV had a profound effect on the nation. The United States Capitol Police did everything we could based on the intelligence and available resources to prepare for this event.
The testimony of Stephen Sund, the former chief of police for the Capitol Police Department, from today's joint oversight hearing that included members of the Senate Rules and Administration Committee and the Homeland Security Governmental Affairs Committee. In just a moment, we'll hear from Jeff Murdoch of the Washington Times what he learned from today's hearing. Senator Roy Blunt focusing on the National Guard issue with Paul Irving. He resigned as the House Sergeant-at-Arms after January 6th. And more from Stephen Sund, who stepped down following the insurrection. We begin with the Missouri Republican.
When asked for National Guard assistance, you approved it. Mr. Sun stated that he asked for the National Guard assistance at 109, and you approved it. It was approved at 210. Why would it take an hour to approve National Guard assistance on your part in that moment of crisis? Mr. Irving.
Senator, from my recollection, I did not receive a request for approval for National Guard until shortly after 2 p.m. when I was in Michael Stanger's office.
All right, let me get that straightened out. Mr. Sun, do you know when you asked for National Guard assistance? Was it 1:09 or was it 2 p.m.?
It was 1:09, sir.
1:09. And who did you ask for assistance at 1:09?
It was from Mr. Irving. I believe he was in the company of Mr. Stanger at the time as well.
And Mr. Irving, why would you not remember that?
Senator, I have no recollection of a conversation with Chief Sund. At that time, I was on the floor during the Electoral College session, and my conversation with Chief Sund in that time frame was shortly before 1:30, when I recall he was describing conditions outside as deteriorating. He may, in fact, be submitting a request. And I carried that forward, and that was as much as I can tell you. I have no phone record of a call from Chief Sund.
Did you discuss that request at 109 or whenever you got it with anybody else, or did you and Mr. Stenger make that decision then?
No, I did not get a request at 109 that I can remember. The first conversation I had with Chief Sund in that time frame was at 128, 130. And in that conversation, he indicated that conditions were deteriorating. He might be looking for National Guard approval and approval of our mutual aid agreements with local law enforcement. And I went to Mike Stenger's office awaiting an update.
Well, this is a time, Mr. Irving, I'm sure my colleagues will want to follow up on this because I'm out of time. But that's a time when the difference in 130 and 210 or 109 and 210 makes a big difference. One of the things I'm wondering, and we don't have time for you to answer this, but I'm going to tell you what I'm thinking here, is in a moment like this, if your focus is chiefly on the safety of House members, and I would certainly understand that, and Mr. Stenger's is chiefly on the safety of Senate members, maybe that's a problem here where the board really can't function as a board because you have such diverse areas of immediate responsibility. But whatever happened here doesn't seem to me to be in agreement with the various time frames, and I'm out of time, Mr. Chairman.
That from Senator Roy Blunt, Republican of Missouri, and a lot of questions remain on that timeline in the early afternoon hours of January the 6th. In a recent radio interview on WISN, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson saying that the uprising in the Capitol was not, in his words, a full-fledged armed assault. And today he claimed that left-wing provocateurs and fake Trump supporters had sparked the violence at the Capitol. Here's part of his statement from earlier today.
What I want to do is, in terms of asking some questions, I want to start out by reading excerpts from what I thought was a very interesting eyewitness account by J. Michael Waller. He is a senior analyst for a strategy at the Center of Security Policy. His areas of concentration include political and psychological warfare and subversion. He's a former professor and instructor at the Institute of World Politics at the Naval Postgraduate School. He's a current lecturer at the John F. Kennedy School Special Warfare Center at Fort Bragg. He wrote this piece titled, I Saw Provocateurs at the Capitol Riot on January 6th. And he basically arrived on scene about 11:30 from Union Station. And I'll just start reading. At about 11:30, I walked from near Union Station and noticed a small number of Capitol Police dressed in full riot gear with shin guards and shoulder guards. Then I walked up Pennsylvania Avenue toward an empty Freedom Park. He noticed that the speech had broken up, and so a crowd was walking down Constitution Avenue. He joined them at 13th Street. But he said the mood of the crowd was positive and festive. Of the thousands of people I passed or who passed me along Constitution Avenue, some were indignant and contemptuous of Congress, but not one appeared angry or incited to riot. Many of the marchers were families with small children. Many were elderly, overweight, or just plain tired or frail, traits not typically attributed to the riot prone. Many wore pro-police shirts or carried pro-police black and blue flags. Although the crowd represented a broad cross-section of Americans, mostly working class by their appearance and manner of speech, some people stood out. A very few didn't share the jovial, friendly, earnest demeanor of the great majority. Some obviously didn't fit in, and he describes four different types of people: plainclothes militants, agents provocateurs, fake Trump protesters, and then disciplined, uniformed column of attackers. I think these are the people that probably planned this. He goes on, the D.C. Metropolitan Police were their usual professionally detached selves, standing on curbs or at street crossings and exchanging an occasional greeting for marchers. When we crossed First Street Northwest to enter the Capitol grounds where the Capitol Police had jurisdiction, I noticed no police at all. Several marchers expressed surprise. The openness seemed like a courtesy gesture from Congress, which controls security. That appearance of low threat level made no sense. Yet no Capitol Police appeared anywhere from what we could see. Now, again, I'm taking these excerpts in order, but there's a lot more to this piece.
Jeff Murdoch of The Washington Times is covering today's joint Senate hearing. I want to begin with what we've been hearing in recent days from Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Bottom line, what is his thinking?
His thinking is he has been trying to downplay the level of the riot today at the hearing. He read a piece from a conservative news outlet that really suggested that the Capitol Police overreacted to the Trump supporters. They were not primarily the ones responsible for storming the Capitol, and that they weren't as violent as been portrayed by the media and in court documents. In terms of what he's thinking, I can't really get into his head, but he definitely seems committed to downplaying and maybe trying to certainly absolve President Trump of some of the accusations of responsibility that have been going, that have been lodged against him out there.
And as you report, we heard from Stephen Sund, the former police chief for U.S. Capitol Police, and he basically said that there was a significant coordination in terms of what happened on January 6th. On that front, what was your takeaway?
Yeah, on that front, I think that's an important takeaway, that we saw significant coordination. It showed that the rioters had come with intent to certainly do damage. I mean, some of the things that he said he saw was specific equipment, explosives, chemical sprays, climbing gear. And one of the things that he had pointed out that I thought was very important was he talked about the pipe bombs that were placed in front of the RNC and DNC headquarters, and he really viewed them as an attempt to scatter Capitol Police so that they wouldn't be at full strength when it came to responding to the riot.
Did you learn anything new today?
Three officials were responsible for the Capitol security at the time of the riot. We learned how they view the incident. I thought one of the most interesting things is they all three of them, squarely pointed a finger at FBI, DHS, and Department of Defense, saying their intelligence assessments completely missed the mark and were inaccurate. Those intelligence assessments, according to these three individuals, said the chances of violence on January 6th at the Capitol were remote to improbable.
And by all accounts, this is really the first of what will be a series of multiple investigations into what happened. Will we see changes in terms of security on Capitol Hill?
I think we will. I think it will take a little bit. I know Senator Klobuchar said today that the current structure of Capitol security isn't feasible, but also said she doesn't think we can go back to the old ways, that the old system that we had before the riot. It'll be interesting to see, I think, what they come up with. I don't think we'll see what they come up with until after, you know, we've got another hearing scheduled next week. You know, the commission has not gotten off the ground yet. But I think when we start to see more hearings, more investigations, we are going to start seeing more security ideas be thrown around to prevent something like this from happening again.
The story at WashingtonTimes.com. Jeff Murdock, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it.
In the Senate, by a vote of 92-7, lawmakers confirming Tom Vilsack as President Biden's agriculture secretary, this sending the former Iowa governor to the same cabinet position he served during the 8 years of the Obama administration. Secretary Vilsack saying his focus will include helping farmers hit hard by trade wars with China and other countries, as well as, of course, dealing with COVID-19. You might remember the stories that the pandemic had sickened thousands of workers at meatpacking plants, especially in the Midwest. New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland testifying today before the Senate Energy and Commerce Committee. She is the president's nominee to become the next Interior Secretary. If confirmed, she would be the first Native American to hold that position. The Democratic lawmaker facing a number of questions on President Biden's plan to stop drilling on public lands. USA Today writing the following, quote, Representative Haaland trying to deflect the criticism from several Republican senators over oil, gas, and coal development, saying public lands could be used more for clean energy, such as wind and solar. And she promised to help fossil fuel workers find new opportunities in an economy that will rely less on carbon-emitting industries. The full story at USAtoday.com. Here is Senator John Barrasso, Republican from Wyoming.
Three senators on this committee are medical doctors. We have Dr. Cassidy, who's a gastroenterologist. Dr. Marshall is an obstetrician. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. And just a couple of months ago, you tweeted, Republicans don't believe in science. Pretty broad statement that you made there, and it was on your, this was in October of 2020, so not too long ago. Mm-hmm. Now, we're also Republicans. Do you think that as medical doctors, we don't believe in science? I mean, how do you stand by this statement?
Senator, I I yes, if you're a doctor, I would assume that you believe in science.
Well, Republicans as well. So, I mean, it's concerning to those of us who've gone through training, believe in science, and yet for a broad brush that we're all, you know, disbelievers, you know, it's a concern to those of us as we're here today to ask questions about. So.
And that from Senator Barrasso and New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland, who is the president's nominee to serve as the next Interior Secretary. Another Biden nominee facing some tough questions by Republicans. California's Attorney General Javier Becerra has been nominated to serve as the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. GOP lawmakers saying he is too liberal and lacks the public health experience to take on the job. From today's Senate Health, Education, Labor and Pensions Committee, here is Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy.
I echo what Senator Burr said, which is that I'm concerned that, I mean, you're a very highly trained attorney, great impeccable credentials. I'm a physician. What would you as the attorney think if I, the physician, were nominated to be the United States Attorney General as opposed to Merrick Garland? You would say, ah, the guy's not qualified. Maybe HHS Secretary, maybe not, but certainly not Attorney General. So you can imagine the kind of concerns I have regarding your nomination. But that said, as Senator Burr said, I have an open mind and just want to go through it. So I'm just going to talk about some of the things that we've talked about on this help committee and see what your thoughts are and to give us a sense of comfort about, you know, the training that you bring. A huge issue has been the 340B program. We've had at least one, maybe two or three hearings on this since I've been a senator. And it's big stakeholders, all of them claiming that they're totally righteous and the truth being somewhere in between. So in that, two key questions. Do we need a statutory definition for contract pharmacy and a statutory definition for patient? If yes, what would those definitions be? And by the way, you may not have thought about this, so I get that. I'm not going to ask you the entire breadth of HHS, just some different sort of questions, and I will be at finance tomorrow, just to kind of let us know the degree to which you're prepared for this job.
Senator, thank you for the question, and thank you for the opportunity previously to sit with you and discuss some of these matters. 340B is an indispensable program for some of our most underserved communities. I know you know this, but for the public that may not understand what the 340B program is, it works with our safety net providers to make sure that some of these forgotten communities have access to some of the essential medications that they need for a reasonable price. And so what we must do is make sure that the law is followed. Your question asks if we should have a statutory definition for contract pharmacy or for a patient. I think the first thing we have to do is enforce the laws that we have in place.
With more in today's hearing, we're joined on the phone with Stephanie Armour, health policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Let me begin on that exchange with Senator Cassidy and Javier Becerra on his experience or lack thereof. Just how big of an issue is this going to be for the HHS nominee?
I think that for Republicans, this is going to be one of the things that they're going to continue to hammer on, especially at the Senate Finance Committee hearing tomorrow, too. Although I found it was interesting that some Republicans did bring up the experience of previous HHS administrators, such as Tom Price, who ultimately did resign over a cloud of sort of some controversy. So I think the Democrats that I've spoken with have said that they plan to push back on the fact that, first of all, they believe Mr. Becerra has a lot of experience simply from his work previously in Congress and as Attorney General on a number of health issues. They're also trying to point out, they told me, that individuals with certain health experience in the past haven't necessarily been, you know, the prime choice or have had sometimes problems in their role as HHS secretary. So I think the question is, how paramount is that? Is kind of one of the points the Democrats also hope to make.
Why did the president select him, and does he face any opposition among Senate Democrats?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, I can't get inside the kind of the president's thinking, but my understanding from talking to people close to the president is that, you know, he's obviously felt for a long time that Mr. Becerra has played a very key role in a lot of the health issues that he, that the president himself is putting as a priority, especially when it comes to access to health care coverage and expanding access on health equity, which is one of an issue Mr. Becerra feels very strongly about in terms of access, and in fact brought up numerous times in the hearing today. I think those issues really resonated with the president, as well as Mr. Becerra's role in leading the defense of the Affordable Care Act from Republican-led states.
As you indicated, today's hearing before the Senate Help Committee, tomorrow before the Senate Finance Committee. So from those Republicans, more of the same line of questioning?
I think we will see that. I think, in fact, it may be more, a little bit more intense from the Senate Finance. You've already seen them raising some of the more contentious issues today about Mr. Becerra's stance on abortion, for example. I think you're going to see them continuing to target him over lack of experience, and you know, some of the people very close to kind of watching what's going on in Congress say that they believe that this may come down to Vice President Harris casting a tie-breaking vote. So we will see, but this is one of the nominees that the Republicans have come out the most forcefully against.
So it could potentially be that close?
Yes, according to the people that I've spoken to on some of the committees, that's what they're thinking could potentially be the case because of how strong the Republican opposition has been.
The story tonight at WSJ.com and in tomorrow's Wall Street Journal. Stephanie Armour here in Washington. Thank you for being with us.
Sure. Thank you.
On Wall Street, the numbers were mixed at the closing bell. The NASDAQ losing 68 points, the Dow gaining 15, the S&P rose by 5. In Los Angeles, investigators are looking into this morning's accident that injured Tiger Woods, his vehicle crashing just past 7 a.m. Paramedics had to use the jaws of life to extricate him from the vehicle. CNN is reporting that he suffered multiple leg injuries, but the L.A. Sheriff's Department indicating that the injuries are not life-threatening. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today here on C-SPAN Radio, also available as a podcast. Here are some of your political headlines. In Georgia, former Senator David Perdue announcing in an email that he would not run next year. That now shifting the focus to two other Republicans weighing a potential bid, including former Senator Kelly Loeffler and former Congressman Doug Collins. Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock winning in a special election last month. He will also be on the ballot in 2022. And Politico was reporting that South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem will greet donors next week at a Mar-a-Lago fundraiser. It will take place on March the 5th, officially a fundraiser for her own re-election, hosted by Donald Trump Jr. The Republican governor has been mentioned as a potential 2024 presidential candidate. Meanwhile, President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden will travel to Houston on Friday. It, of course, follows a deadly winter storm that hit the state hard with snow and sub-freezing temperatures. In fact, the state had issued its first ever winter storm warning. As a result, the Texas electric grid had failed, leaving millions without power, heat, or water. Now, power has since been restored across much of the state, but many remain without clean water. From today's White House briefing, Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Finally, I have one travel announcement, which you all have been asking about. We, of course, remain in close touch with state and local elected officials to monitor the recovery. And on Friday, the president and the first lady will travel to Houston. The president will meet with local leaders to discuss the winter storm, relief efforts, progress toward recovery, and the incredible resilience shown by the people of Houston and Texas. While in Texas, the president will also visit a COVID health center where vaccines are being distributed. Clearly, there are still more details of the trip coming together. And as we have those, we will make those available to all of you.
Also from today's White House briefing, the Biden administration announcing that states will be receiving about 14.5 million doses of the coronavirus vaccine this week. That, by the way, marking a nearly 70% increase in distribution of doses over last month. More with Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Today on his weekly governor's call with America's governors, our COVID coordinator, Jeff Zients, announced the fifth consecutive week of supply increases. States will now receive 14.5 million doses this week, up from 8.6 million doses per week when the president took office. That's an increase in vaccine allocations of nearly 70% during the Biden-Harris administration. The retail pharmacy program has also performed well despite the winter storm. We announced last week an increase of 1 to 2 million doses, and our COVID coordinator, Jeff Zients, I should say, conveyed to the governors we will increase that allocation by 100,000 doses this week. Thanks to the president's efforts, we are also on track to have enough vaccines for 300 million Americans by the end of July, and we continue to encourage Americans to mask up, respect social distancing, and abide by the public health guidelines.
That's from the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, executives from two of America's leading drug companies telling lawmakers that they project a major increase in vaccine deliveries that will result in 140 million more doses over the next 5 weeks. Pfizer and Moderna announcing that they have solved some of the manufacturing issues which did delay the distribution of those vaccines. John Young is the chief business officer for Pfizer, with questions from Representative Diana DeGette, the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee, which held today's hearing.
So I just want to ask some questions going forward about where we expect to be for vaccine production and distribution. Mr. Young, I'll start with you. Last October, Pfizer CEO said he expected Pfizer to deliver 30 to 40 million doses to the U.S. by the end of 2020. But Pfizer only hit the 40 million mark last week. And I was just wondering, you have said that you're going to provide the federal government 300 million doses by the end of July. Given current production levels, are you going to be able to meet that deadline?
Well, thank you for your question. It's correct to say that, you know, we did initially experience some problems with the initial ramp up of our vaccine. And I think in common with other panelists here, we've been in the process of developing a manufacturing process for a vaccine product that we've never made before. We particularly saw some rate-limiting steps with raw materials, but we anticipate that we will be on track to deliver those 300 million doses before the end of July.
The Washington Post writing the following, quote, "If the companies are able to meet their projections, it would signal the beginning of the end of a period of deep frustration and mark faster progress against a pandemic that has claimed more than 500,000 lives in the U.S. The slower than anticipated vaccine rollout has hampered progress towards vaccinating the 70 or 80% of the U.S. population of 330 million people required to achieve herd immunity against the coronavirus." We'll talk to the Post business and healthcare reporter Chris Rowland in just a moment. But first, more from today's hearing. Here is Texas Republican Congressman Michael Burgess and more from Pfizer's chief business officer, John Young.
Been a lot of discussion over the past week and certainly last weekend about the use of real world evidence and how that may impact things going forward. So at my understanding, at the current time, the FDA cannot rely on real world evidence. But do you have any thoughts? Again, this is for Dr. Hogan and Mr. Young, who have vaccines in production in the United States. Is real-world evidence of value for you?
Maybe I can start, John Young from Pfizer. Yes, we believe that the FDA's approach to, you know, look to answer the first basic question around the safety and effectiveness in randomized clinical control trials is, you know, very appropriate. But we do believe there's an enormous value for regulators, but also public health officials, to really understand the safety and also the effectiveness, you know, of a vaccine in real-world clinical practice in much larger populations than can be possible in a randomized clinical control trial. We had 46,000 patients in our clinical study, but we already have data from millions of patients around the world who have been vaccinated. And that data, we believe, can be enormously helpful and informative to public health officials.
With more in today's House hearing, we're joined on the phone with Chris Rowland. He covers the business of healthcare for The Washington Post. And I want to begin with the issue of the Biden administration trying to hold these companies accountable for their commitments. How will they do that?
Well, the Biden administration has been engaging very directly with each of the companies, trying to ascertain exactly where the snags have been in their manufacturing and then their distribution, and, you know, what sort of raw materials problems they're having, what kind of, you know, machinery they need or additional assistance with infrastructure or any of those types of things, really trying to prod them to, you know, step up and get up to the levels that they've promised. I think a lot of this volume that we're seeing now that's beginning to increase and is promised to increase in the very near future, probably would have happened anyway under the plan. I mean, I think what happened was that there was a slower than expected rollout through, you know, December and January, which obviously caused a lot of frustration around the country. But the companies were always going to be, you know, heading towards the goal of hundreds of millions of doses and, you know, ultimately billions of doses by the end of 2021.
Also in your story available at WashingtonPost.com, we learned that the federal government has agreed to spend about $16 billion in lab and clinical development. How is that used by these leading drug makers?
So this was Operation Warp Speed last year, committed $16 billion to encourage these companies and to subsidize these companies to develop their vaccines. They basically placed multiple bets on about six different companies, several different types of vaccine technology. They also invested heavily, hundreds of millions of dollars for several of the companies in providing money to start manufacturing early. So even while the clinical trials were going on, the government was funding manufacturing before they even knew if the vaccines would work, so that they would theoretically create a stockpile of vaccines by the time that the emergency use authorization was issued. Now, unfortunately, that those stockpiles never materialized in the amounts that the government was hoping. But yet, I think that that money is still beginning to pay off now as we head into mid, you know, early spring here. It's just several months late that those stockpiles are appearing.
So based on what you heard in today's hearing and this uptick in the distribution, will we see more mass vaccine sites? What's the path moving ahead?
So that's really interesting. And so it's going to be a good problem to have, right? But the dynamic is going to switch around. Whereas right now, there's such a scarcity of vaccine, and the big concern is that there's just not enough for states to administer. Within another month, in a month and a half, that dynamic will kind of flip, and there's going to be so much vaccine that the big problem for states is how to create these major systems to get literally tens of millions of people vaccinated in a matter of, you know, weeks and months. And what you'll see is more mass vaccination sites, states, you know, becoming more collaborative with CVS and Walgreens and trying to figure out how they can coordinate with, you know, your local retail pharmacies. You'll see all multiple channels being flooded with vaccine. So it'll go from the mass vaccination sites to, you know, storefront retail pharmacies to continuing at, you know, hospitals. And ultimately, you know, when things become more normalized down later in the year, you know, you'll be able to contact your doctor and they'll be able to tell you how to get one.
The headline at WashingtonPost.com, vaccine makers Pfizer and Moderna pledging massive boost to U.S. supply after a sluggish rollout. The reporting of Chris Rowland, he covers the business of healthcare for The Washington Post. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, a note on Senator Ted Cruz. He again apologized today for his trip to Cancun, Mexico last week. Of course, that trip came amid a crippling power and water crisis across his home state. But he also complained about his own family's treatment by the media. He was asked about those leaked text messages from his wife, Heidi. The interview on the podcast released earlier today titled Ruthless.
Yeah, I will say Heidi's pretty pissed at that. She actually was over at a neighbor's house yesterday, sort of walking through. So she texted several of our neighbors. Now, look, our neighbors, we've got a number of Republicans who are neighbors, but we also have a number of Democrats. Right. And so, you know, with folks on our street who put up Beto signs, which I thought was a little rude, but you know, I was, you know, I didn't like hold a victory party in their front yards when we won. So, you know, I was, look, obviously, so it's a sign of how ridiculously politicized and nasty and just, you know, here's a suggestion. Just don't be assholes.
Yeah,
like, just, you know, treat each other as human beings. Have some degree, some modicum of respect.
And those comments in a podcast released earlier today with Texas Senator Ted Cruz. This reminder, Washington Today is also available as a podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. All of our coverage online anytime at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully in Washington, hoping you enjoy the rest of your Tuesday evening.